Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading articles from the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper. These stories are for the week of Sunday, September 4th, 2022. And to be quite honest with you, this is a pitiful set of articles from this newspaper this week. We have all of two locally written San Angelo stories, one Abilene story, some state news stories, a few local sports stories. We'll wrap things up with the horticulture column. We may get to an hour or we may not. We'll see. Our first of the two local articles, Angelo State Football Players Arrested for On-Campus Robbery by Rosanna Frere, published September 2nd. Six Angelo State University football players were arrested Wednesday, August 31st, after allegedly assaulting and robbing a man on the ASU campus Friday, August 26th. We are aware of this matter and are working closely with university officials and law enforcement, wrote Brittany Miller, Angelo State University Director of Communication and Marketing, in reply to an email request from the Standard Times for comment. The student athletes involved have been suspended from all football team activities. As this is an ongoing investigation, we cannot provide additional comments at this time, Miller wrote. All six have been removed from the official roster for the ASU football team on the AngeloSports.com website. DeCorian Hammond, Cameron Kirkwood, Roy Morris, Brendan Frizzell, Stilton McKelvey, and Michael Murphy were arrested August 31st and booked into the Tom Green County Jail on robbery charges. All but McKelvey were released with bond set at $25,000 each, according to jail records. They are accused of committing the theft of property, including white LeBron basketball shoes, a basketball, and a black Adidas backpack, with intent to obtain and maintain control of the property and knowingly causing bodily injury by striking the victim in the head and upper torso, according to the arrest affidavit from Tom Green County. The arrest affidavit stated on Friday, August 26th, Hammond, Kirkwood, Morris, Frizzell, McKelvey, and Murphy left the Texan Hall dorm parking lot located off South Jackson Street around 7:30 p.m. while the victim was leaving the Super Slab basketball court on campus. The Super Slab is located near the planetarium and across from the Rassman Building. Video provided by a defendant showed Hammond, Morris, and Frizzell assault the man in a campus parking lot by striking him in the head and upper torso with their closed fists and feet, according to arrest affidavits. The video also showed Frizzell with the black Adidas bag in his possession, according to the affidavit. Frizzell and Murphy were then caught on security camera 15 minutes later with the victim's basketball, while Morris was shown in possession of the backpack. According to the affidavit does not state where the location is of the shoes. The victim told Angelo State University police that he did not give any of the six defendants permission to take his personal property, the affidavit stated. All six men were in the February 2022 signing class for the Rams football team. McKelvey, 19, who played for Houston Cashmere, was listed as a defensive back. Frizzell, 18, was a defensive back from Houston Cypress Woods. Kirkwood, 18, was a wide receiver from Crosby. Morris, 18, was a strong safety, and Hammond, 18, was a running back. Both are from Houston King. Murphy, 19, was a wide receiver from DeSoto. San Angelo Cowboy Gathering Celebrating 10-Year Anniversary This Weekend by Rosanna Frere, published September 7th. Tickets are still available for the 10th annual San Angelo Cowboy Gathering this weekend. The Western Swing Music event will be held Friday, September 9th and Saturday, September 10th at the First Financial Pavilion, 50 East 43rd Street. Tickets are $50 per day or $75 for a two-day pass. Tickets can be purchased at the door or by calling 325-763-9923. This year's event will be in memory and tribute to Skibo Norris, benefiting the House of Faith. Skibo was our longtime MC and auctioneer, said Terry Holland, one of the event organizers. He was an award-winning radio DJ from San Saba, Texas, rodeo announcer, and all-around great man. Norris passed away due to heart complications in October 2021. His wife, grown daughters, grandkids, and sister will be here with us this weekend, Holland said. We will present his wife with a special gift on behalf of Skibo's dedication to our festival and the music we all love and celebrate. Here is the full schedule of the event. September 9th, doors open at 11:30 a.m. Noon, the Old Hat Band. 1:30 p.m., Monty Good. 3 p.m., Daryl McCall and Tony Booth. 4:30 p.m., San Angelo Chamber Ribbon Cutting. 5 p.m., Jody Nix and the Texas Cowboys. 6:45 p.m., Jake Hooker and the Outsiders. 8:30 p.m., Raffle and Silent Auction Ends. 9 p.m., Jeff Woolsey and the Dance Hall Kings. 11:30 p.m., Closing. September 10th, 10 to 11 a.m., Cowboy Church. Noon, Chuck Cusimano and Country Enough. 1:30 p.m., Brady Honeycutt. 3 p.m., Billy Mata and the Texas Tradition with Floyd Domino. 4:30 p.m., Justin Trevino Band. 5:45 to 6:15 p.m., Honoring Skibo Norris Live Auction. 6:15 p.m., Rocky King Band. 7:45 p.m., Jason Roberts Band. 9 p.m., Jody Nix and the Texas Cowboys. 11:30 p.m., Closing. Abilene woman arrested for sex trafficking her daughter. By Laura Gutskill, Abilene Reporter News, printed in the San Angelo Standard Times, September 6th. An Abilene woman was arrested Friday for allegedly accepting money from men to have sex with her daughter, according to a court document. Ashley Dale Franklin was arrested on a second-degree felony charge of trafficking person and taken to Taylor County Jail. Her bond was set at $150,000, according to jail records. The Austin Police Department began an investigation after being contacted by federal authorities regarding a child pornography case, the document said, with the victim making an outcry of abuse. When the victim lived with her mother for about 3 years, starting about January 1st, 2015, men would have multiple sexual acts with the child, the document said. The victim did not know the names of the men. During the sexual assaults, the mother would be present and supervise, the document said. The men would pay the victim's mother, who used the money to buy drugs, the document said. The victim was assaulted about every other day for a period of more than 30 days. Investigators also interviewed two younger children under Franklin's care at that time. They corroborated the victim's statements about drug use and multiple men in the house, the document said. During a polygraph exam, Franklin showed deception when she denied these events occurred, the document said. Those are the local and area articles. Now we'll move to state stories. $168 million in Permian Basin oil and gas assets sold as region the focus of market growth. By Adrian Hedden, Carlsbad Current Argus. Published September 7th in the Standard Times. Despite a dip in oil prices to start September, energy companies continued to ramp up fossil fuel operations in the Permian Basin of southeast New Mexico and west Texas, riding an upward trend in fuel demand. Ring Energy, based in the Woodlands, Texas, was the latest to expand its presence in the region, announcing September 1st it acquired the Permian assets of Stronghold Energy 2 Operating for about $168 million. The deal included about 37,000 acres of oil and gas development, mostly in Crane County, Texas, south of Odessa, Texas, in the eastern Midland sub-basin of the Permian. Ring Chief Executive Officer Paul McKinney said the deal was meant to strengthen the company's focus on the central and northwest portions of the Permian Basin. The combination further diversifies our commodity mix, significantly enhances our size and scale, lowers our per-barrel operating costs, provides for meaningful synergies and increased operations optionality on multiple fronts, and most important, is immediately accretive across key operational and financial metrics for Ring stockholders, McKinney said. Another Texas company, Houston-based Riverbend Energy Group, also planned to target the Permian Basin to capitalize on growth in the market, selling $1.8 billion in assets in August and announcing plans to shift operations to the region. Riverside Energy Group announced the divestiture of its assets in the Bakken Shale region of North Dakota, Utica Shale in the Appalachian region, Fayetteville Shale in the southeast U.S., and the Haynesville Shale in parts of East Texas and northwest Louisiana. That amounted to 11,000 oil and gas wells, with producing about 47,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day. The company announced following the sell-off that it was looking to make new investments in both the western Delaware and eastern Midland sub-basins in the Permian, along with other shale regions in the U.S. Riverbend Chief Executive Officer Randy Newcomer said the company planned to continue growing its investments in the fossil fuel industry, but also in the energy transition sector to include renewable energy projects. "We will continue to provide similar investment opportunities to institutional investors in the traditional energy business, alongside our rapidly expanding energy transition segment," he said. To cash in on increasing value and demand for Permian Basin operations, Laredo Petroleum also announced the sale of $110 million in non-operated properties in Howard County, with plans to continue shifting its investments in the region. That deal was expected to close in October and included the sale of 1,650 acres the company estimated could produce about 1,800 barrels of oil equivalent per day. "We have built a deep portfolio of high-quality development locations, which we consistently optimize through the acquisition of high-return assets and sale of certain non-core properties," said Laredo CEO Jason Pigott. Five new wells were announced to start producing crude oil on the New Mexico and Texas side of the basin last week, with Permex Petroleum announcing it recompleted wells in Eddy County, New Mexico, and Martin County, Texas, targeting new underground shale formations. Together, the wells were initially producing about 50 barrels per day, stabilizing at 35 barrels. That increased the company's daily production to 71 barrels per day. Permex also planned to bring 62 shut-in oil and gas wells and saltwater disposal wells back into service for further growth in its operations in the region, increasing production 48% since June. The results obtained through the minor stimulation and treatment of the recent wells are in line with our strategy to add sustainable marginal production through low-risk, low-cost recompletions while preparing for drilling programs for continued growth, said Permex CEO Marin Eschen. The U.S. oil and gas industry's focus on the Permian Basin continued despite a downward trend in pricing. On Tuesday, domestic oil was trading at about $87 a barrel per data from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. This marked a gradual decline from $97 a barrel reported August 29th per historical data from NASDAQ. But operational costs in the Permian were viewed to be lower than other shale regions, analysts said, following a historic drop in oil prices and market activity in 2020 amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Since the markets recovered over the past 2 years, operators in the region aim to increase efficiency both in operations and in investments, consolidating assets rather than driving up production of oil and gas. Wells costs in the Permian dropped in recent years as operators applied lessons learned to improve capital efficiency, read a March 2021 report from Enverus. In response to the plummeting commodity prices in mid-2020, activity across all shale plays hit the brakes, resulting in a substantial decline in service costs, the report said. That could also be behind an uptick in oil and gas rigs throughout New Mexico, Texas, and the Permian region as a whole. New Mexico added 2 rigs in the last week per Baker Hughes, with 108 as of Friday, up 26 rigs in the last year. Texas was up by 130 in the last year for a total of 362 as of Friday, Baker Hughes reported, while the Permian was at 342 rigs, an increase of 92 since the same date in 2021. Two DPS officers suspended for actions during Uvalde shooting response. The head of the state's top law enforcement agency told his department that troopers must overcome any delays in confronting a mass shooter. By John C. Moritz and Tony Piotsky, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published September 7th in the Standard Times. Two Texas Department of Public Safety officers have been suspended with pay amid a review of the agency's role in the bungled response to the May 24th Uvalde school shooting. Those officers, as well as others, have been referred to the agency's Inspector General's office for a formal investigation into their actions surrounding the massacre at Robb Elementary School that left 19 children and two teachers dead, the Austin American Statesman has learned. The investigation into the actions of these officers, who were identified as part of a review that the DPS announced in July, will help the agency's Inspector General's office to determine if any policy violations happened, as well as any violation of training and what disciplinary action those officers should face, DPS spokesman Travis Constein said Tuesday. There was no announced timeline under which the Inspector General's office will complete its investigation. This revelation came on the heels of a newly disclosed internal email in which the head of the DPS said the agency shares in what he called the abject failure that led to the 77-minute delay in responding May 24th to the state's deadliest school shooting. The email, timestamped Wednesday, July 20th, 12:16 p.m., 1 month after DPS Colonel Steve McGraw testified before a select committee of the Texas Senate, contained a more explicit acknowledgement that the DPS troopers on the scene should have acted more aggressively to confront the shooter. Video footage from inside the school, obtained by the Statesman and KVUE, show numerous officers from several law enforcement agencies outside the classroom where the massacre played out, while the gunman was reportedly barricaded inside. By the time the gunman had been shot dead by a team led by the U.S. Border Patrol, 376 law officers had responded, 91 of them from the DPS. McGraw's email leaves little doubt that the DPS cannot wait in the event of a similar mass shooting. DPS officers responding to an active shooter at a school will be authorized to overcome any delay to neutralizing an attacker, McGraw wrote. When a subject fires a weapon at a school, he remains an active shooter until he is neutralized and is not to be treated as a barricaded subject. Because the shooting happened at a Uvalde school campus, many experts have said then-Uvalde School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo was the on-scene commander. The now-fired chief later said he did not consider himself to be in full charge of the law enforcement response. In his Senate testimony, McGraw cautioned lawmakers not to push for a policy that would automatically make the DPS the agency in charge during mass violence within a local jurisdiction. Every agency that responded that day shares in this failure, including DPS, McGraw wrote. Although I remain highly critical of the decision to treat the incident as a barricaded subject by the ranking consolidated independent school district police official at the scene, DPS and other agencies must also be held accountable for their actions or inactions. It is clear from the evidence law enforcement should have treated this situation as an active shooter event. The ongoing criminal investigation by the Texas Rangers includes the examination of the actions of every law enforcement officer who responded to the scene. The email was part of a small cache of documents related to the shooting and its aftermath requested by State Senator Roland Gutierrez, a San Antonio Democrat whose district includes Uvalde. Gutierrez, in an interview, said he was grateful that McGraw had accepted at least part of the responsibility for the botched response, but he continued his sharp criticism that the public is not being given a full accounting about the action and inaction by law enforcement at every level. We asked for radio transmissions. We asked for body cam footage, Gutierrez said, but we didn't get much of anything besides the emails. A DPS spokesman did not respond to a call for comment regarding McGraw's email or Gutierrez's response to it. McGraw, in testimony before the Senate panel and in public comments, was among the harshest critics of Arredondo, saying the district's police chief had decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children. Arredondo was fired by the Uvalde School Board last month, and a report by a special Texas House committee, released nearly 2 months after the shooting, echoed that criticism, but said it was not limited to Arredondo and his small school district police force. Instead, the panel cited systemic failures and egregious poor decision-making, Investigators for the committee found that other law enforcement officers on the scene also failed to act, and that they should have stepped up and taken charge once it became obvious that there was no clear incident commander from the local or school police who was directing the response. Hundreds of responders from numerous law enforcement agencies, many of whom were better trained and better equipped than the school district police, quickly arrived on the scene and could have helped to address the unfolding chaos, the report said. A Uvalde shooting survivor can't bear to return to school. She isn't the only one. By Nikki Griswold, Austin American Statesman, published September 6th in the Standard Times. Uvalde. You can still see the bullet fragments in 11-year-old Micah Cerrillo's left shoulder. The size of a small coin, the wound could be a scar tissue or a birthmark, if not for the small dark spots just under the surface. They are also embedded in her back, where, especially on her left side, they still cause her pain. Where the bullet fragments struck her on the sides of her head, the paths they carved burned away some of her hair. Micah loves her hair. Those little pieces of metal, which her mom says that doctors hope will eventually make their way out of her skin, are physical reminders of the day that still haunts her and so many other people in her hometown of Uvalde. Micah was in the fourth grade classroom at Robb Elementary School on May 24th when an 18-year-old wielding a semi-automatic rifle burst through the door and killed 19 students, many of them Micah's friends, and her two teachers. She survived by covering herself in a classmate's blood and playing dead. The massacre, the worst school shooting in Texas history, shocked and devastated the tight-knit community of just over 15,000, where it seems everyone knows someone directly touched by the tragedy. Uvalde School Superintendent Hal Harrell announced in June that no students will be returning to Robb Elementary, which will eventually be demolished and rebuilt. All Robb students will instead be funneled to other elementary schools in the district. But when students returned to classrooms on Tuesday, Micah, still experiencing profound emotional and mental trauma, will not be among them. Instead, she will be attending school virtually, which school officials announced this summer would be an option for the upcoming school year. As a week before the start of classes, the district said 136 students had enrolled in the virtual academy. But even those who are returning to classrooms and their parents are racked with fear that a shooting could happen again. Children of all ages in Uvalde suffer from nightmares, anxiety, and depression, according to multiple interviews in Uvalde last week. District officials delayed the start of school to give more time to add security features, such as improving locks on doors, adding security cameras and fencing, and having additional patrols. But a week before classes were set to begin, Harrell told parents that some of the safety improvements won't be done in time for the first day of classes, including the installation of additional security cameras and securing school vestibules and entrances. The gunman hopped over a fence on the Robb Elementary campus before entering through an unlocked door. Some parents are choosing to send their children to neighboring districts or enroll them in private school, saying they can't trust the district to keep their children safe. The school board fired District Police Chief Pete Arredondo last month after Arredondo was singled out by state officials for his role in the bungled police response to the shooting. Nearly 400 officers from more than a dozen departments, some of them heavily armed and carrying shields, rushed to the school. But for reasons that are still not fully understood, officers waited 77 minutes after first arriving to confront and kill the gunman, even as kids inside, including Micah, called 911 pleading for help. Parents and students have spent the summer working to hold school district leaders, law enforcement officials, and politicians accountable, calling for safer schools, more mental health resources, the resignation of top officials, and gun safety measures. But in spite of their advocacy, officials responsible for the police response have pointed fingers at one another, and Governor Greg Abbott has ignored pleas to reconvene the legislature to tackle gun violence. Now the ritual of a school year starting anew, which had been a moment of joy and hope in years past, is dredging up the painful memories of the shooting and exposing wounds that still feel raw. Micah is not the same. Sitting in a local Starbucks one recent afternoon, Micah was quiet, reserved, her shoulders slightly tensed, her curly hair pulled back into a ponytail, and her glasses dotted by the raindrops of a passing storm. Her mom, Abigail Veloz, explains that loud noises like the crash of thunder and the pounding of the rain on the Starbucks roof scare her. Micah is not the same, Veloz said. Micah was a happy kid, singing, TikToks, dancing. None of my kids were ever afraid of anything. This is not Micah. Now, Micah is afraid of everything. The noise, the sirens, the thunder. It's been just over 3 months since Micah's 17-year-old brother, Donovan, watched her emerge from Robb Elementary, covered in blood. We thought something had happened to her, Veloz said. They put the survivors in a bus, and I was talking to her through the window, and I asked her if she was all right. She said it wasn't her blood. Micah doesn't like to talk about what she saw that day. It was a lot for a kid to see, even for myself. The next day, when she told me detail by detail, I got dizzy. I went to the restroom. I threw up, Veloz said. Micah spent the summer at home with her four siblings, rarely leaving the house because it's where she feels safest. It's our privacy. It's our home. She feels comfortable, Veloz said. We have movie nights where we'll put an air mattress in the living room and everybody grabs a pillow and blanket. Micah can't be in a room by herself, so her family members have developed a buddy system. Even when she's showering, she props a brace at the bottom of the door to keep it open, also letting her older brothers know not to come in. Her mom has slept with her every night since May 24th, at first in the same bed and now in a twin bed right next to Micah's. She has a really hard time sleeping, a lot of nightmares. The thunder at night, it's really hard for her, Veloz said. When I see her having a hard night, I get up and check on her, and usually we wake up together and we'll just wait, or she'll tell me what she's dreaming about and see if it helps. Her mom says she's taken Micah to her doctor multiple times because the girl hasn't had an appetite. That's when Micah told her she was seeing her classmate's blood on the food in front of her. Micah now sees a therapist once a week. It's not something she particularly enjoys, but her mom is considering having her go twice a week, since her nightmares are getting worse. When Micah does leave the house, her mom says they have to be ready to leave when Micah needs to go home. We'll go to Walmart to get the kids out of the house, just to look around and do some shopping, but she has a fear. She thinks men are following her. So once that kicks in, it's time to go, Veloz says. Micah has found comfort in self-care, doing face masks, hair, makeup, and drawing, sketching flowers, and coloring cow print patterns. She's picked up doing makeup. A lot of people are like, she's too little. She is, but it keeps her happy at home. Like, she does her hair, she does my hair. She does her makeup. She loves to go get her nails done, Veloz said. She plans on dyeing a portion of her hair next to her face, a dark royal blue, her favorite color. But healing takes time, and with the start of the school year right around the corner, Micah's mom knew Micah couldn't go back, not yet. I know she doesn't want to go to school because she's afraid it's going to happen again, Veloz said. She's not ready to leave home. She's just not. And I'm not going to push her. You know, she's not ready. I have to protect my child. Uvalde parent on being ready to send Zayn back to school in person. Children who were inside Robb Elementary on May 24th, even those who weren't in the two classrooms the gunman targeted, said they're not sure when they'll feel safe at school again. 8-year-old Zayn Martinez was in his second grade classroom where his teacher had just started playing a movie when he heard children screaming outside. That's when he said a couple of kids and two teachers ran into his classroom, and then his teacher locked the door and told them to get under their desks. They were scared, Zayn said. We started crying. About the same time, 37-year-old Adam Martinez, Zayn's father, was eating enchiladas at a restaurant when his phone rang. My wife called me hysterical, saying there was an active shooter at Rob, Martinez said. I didn't even pay for the bill. I got up, I took off, and I got there in like 2 minutes. I was going down the highway as fast as I could. When he got to Rob, he says, there were already quite a few cars and police officers at the school. He ran toward the campus, trying to get as close as he could. That's when he ended up with a group of parents arguing with law enforcement officers. They're pushing the parents back. I was there telling them, y'all need to go in. Why don't y'all go in? And they were like, it's because we're having to deal with you all. Like, blaming us on why they couldn't go in, Martinez said. At some point, Zion doesn't remember how long it took, officers reached Zion's classroom and told the students to run. Martinez's 18-year-old daughter, Janelle, who also had rushed to Rob in a panic, saw Zion running out of the school and across the hot asphalt to safety with no shoes. He had taken them off to get comfortable while watching the movie and, amid the fear and panic, forgot to put them back on. Martinez rushed to pick up his 12-year-old daughter from her middle school, while his wife drove to the Civic Center, where children were being bused to be reunited with their parents. When she found him, he was crying. Since then, the Martinezes have tried to make it a normal summer for their kids. Zion has kept busy playing on a traveling baseball team, but his parents began noticing some changes in him. There's some things that he worries about now that he never used to. Locked doors, lights that aren't on, hearing noises or gunshots. Sometimes you'll hear gunshots here because of hunting or just because of the neighborhood we're in, and he'll be worried, Martinez said. He's asking if the door's locked. He never used to worry about that. He has nightmares, too. There's quite a few nightmares. It's tough to deal with. It wasn't until recently, when they began shopping for the new school year, that Martinez realized Zion wasn't ready to go back to school. As we talked about it, he was traumatized, saying, "What do you mean? I don't want to go." Like, really traumatized, Martinez said. He wasn't having it. He wasn't going to go. Martinez tried to reassure him that there would be new fencing and more police, but it didn't calm Zion like he had hoped. He's like, "Well, who cares if there's police officers? They're not going to do anything. They're not going to go in. They're not going to protect me." So that's when we kind of made that firm decision that he's not ready, Martinez said. They decided that Zion and his 12-year-old sister would not be going back to campuses this fall, and instead would participate in the Uvalde School District's virtual option. I have to protect my child, and even if he is safer, the perception is that he's not safe. How is he going to learn? Martinez said. You're worried about your life, so you can't focus. We have to keep them safe. We have to change that perception. In the aftermath of the tragedy, Martinez says he's gotten deeply involved in advocacy work, trying to do his part to push for accountability from the school council, from the city council, law enforcement, and elected officials. Nothing was happening. Nobody was getting fired. It was such a cowardly act. It was embarrassing to even live in Uvalde. So I had to stand up for what was right, Martinez said. Sometimes in the small towns, things get pushed under the rug, and I wanted to protest. I wanted to help. I'm worried that this is going to happen again. Absidy's hesitancy on going back to school. As 11-year-old Absidy Flores sits on a plush chair in the El Progreso Memorial Library in Uvalde, her eyes well up with tears at the first mention of what happened at Rob Elementary. Absidy went to Rob for third and fourth grade before transferring to another elementary school in the district for its dual language program. She was on a field trip with her classmates when the shooting happened, and she found out about it on the way back. A lot of my friends started crying because they had a lot of friends and family members there, she said, tears rolling down her face. I was scared because I had a cousin in the school, because I had friends there. Two of Absidy's friends, Ellie Garcia and Layla Salazar, died that day. Absidy cries every time she thinks about what happened. She lives with her great-grandmother, Maria Melchor, who worries about her. She says Absidy has been depressed for the past 3 months, and she doesn't have anyone to speak to about what happened besides her. Absidy, who loves to draw and dance, made drawings of each of the victims, and she went to all the funerals to say goodbye. But still, her great-grandmother notices she's deeply sad. Speaking to Absidy in Spanish, she says, "Sometimes you ask me, where are the children? Where are they? Where did they go? Well, what can I tell you is that they went with God. That's all I can tell you because they are no longer here." Many of them were her friends, and I try for her to not be thinking too much about that, Melcher said. Despite her security fears, she has decided to send Absidy back to school in person this fall. "I'm worried that this is going to happen again. I would like the schools to have more security, more surveillance for the children," Melcher said. "But she was already locked up because of the pandemic, and then because of this. She has to go to get distracted and also to see her friends." She also wants Absidy to return to school so she can see the school counselor about how she has been feeling. The Uvalde School District has expanded the social and emotional support resources available for students who are still struggling with the long-term trauma associated with the shooting, hiring additional mental health professionals and counselors who specialize in trauma and grief. All the district staff also completed trauma-enforced care training prior to the start of school. At school, they say they were going to have a counselor every day of the week. "That's why I want her to go to school," Melcher said. "I also want them to help her a little bit. I mean, she's a good kid. She gets good grades." "I'm kind of nervous," Absidy said, "but I'm kind of excited because I really want to learn new stuff and go see my friends. I'm afraid, scared, worried. But as I told her, I'm going to let her take her phone with her now. I used to never let her take it with her so she doesn't get distracted. But now I'm going to tell her to take it," Melcher said, "so Absidy can call her if anything happens." Micah fears for her sibling, Junior, attending pre-K. Micah's younger sister, 9-year-old Elena, will be attending classes virtually with her. But Micah's older siblings will be going back to school in person, including her youngest sibling, 4-year-old Miguel Cerrillo Jr., whom they call Junior. Micah told her mom that Junior is the first person she thought of when the shooting happened, when she thought she wasn't going to make it, and she wasn't going to be able to see him grow up. Now, Junior is starting pre-K this fall, and Micah and her mom recently picked him up from a Meet the Teacher night on campus. "On the way home, she did tear up and say she didn't want us to send him to school, but I don't want to take that from him because it's his first year, and he was really excited," Veloz said. "I guess because we've been home all summer and just sticking around, she just wants everybody to continue doing that." Just over 2 weeks after the shooting, Micah shared her first-person account of the massacre via a pre-recorded video with the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Reform for a hearing on gun violence. She emphasized that she's scared that a mass shooting will happen again, and she wants lawmakers to take action to make sure it doesn't. Her mom says Micah told her she's terrified for the next time an elementary school is attacked with a classroom of children Junior's age who won't be old enough to know to keep quiet and play dead like she did. It's a fear she's not sure will go away. "Everybody keeps telling us it's going to take time, but I'm like, I don't know. I don't see her getting any better, but I don't see her getting any worse. I don't know if that makes sense," Veloz said. "I think as we go day by day, she just kind of learns how to live with herself." And now sports. San Angelo Central shakes off El Paso Montwood 54-49 in home debut, by Charles Bryce, published September 3rd. It was only the second game of the regular season, but it had the feel of a state championship battle Friday night at San Angelo Stadium. The San Angelo Central High School football team held off El Paso Montwood 52-49 on an 18-yard field goal by Chase Miller with 30 seconds left in the fourth quarter. "I think I lost a few years of my life after that one," Central head coach Kevin Crane joked. "I told our kids after the game that I think I had 4 or 5 heart attacks and lost 10 years off of my life. I'm just so proud of them, the way they hung in there and finished it off." Central improved to 1-1, while Montwood dropped to 0-2. Last year in El Paso, Central edged Montwood 34-29. It was a back-and-forth battle all night long Friday between the Bobcats and Rams. Central built a 28-20 advantage at intermission after being up by as much as 21-6 in the first half. Bobcats quarterback Tyler Hill ran for touchdowns of 4, 44, and 59 yards and finished with 13 carries for 176 yards. Passing-wise, he was 11 of 15 for 142 yards and a 32-yard TD strike to wide receiver Jacob English. English was the Bobcats' leading receiver with 3 receptions for 61 yards and 1 TD. Central running back Tyree Brawley scored on runs of 1 and 9 yards. He finished with 22 carries for 122 yards. Teammate Javian Robinson had 9 carries for 73 yards. The Bobcats had a TD on special teams as Austin Johnson returned a blocked punt 31 yards for a score. Central led 42-35 after Hill's 59-yard TD run at the 10:41 mark of the fourth quarter. Montwood pulled even 42-42 on a 16-yard TD connection from quarterback Isaac Galvin to Diego Oxaga with 7:03 left in regulation. The Bobcats regained the lead on the Hill to Jacobs TD toss at the 6:26 mark of the fourth. The snap went high over the Central QB's head, but he had composure to get a hold of it and find English all along down the right sideline, making it 49-42 Central. Montwood wasn't done yet. With 6:17 left in the final period, the Rams took over at their own 37-yard line and marched 63 yards on 8 plays, culminating in a 5-yard TD run by Isaiah Claudio. His third TD of the game knotted the contest at 49-49 with 4:39 left. Central took over at its 25, and 11 plays later, Miller connected on the 18-yard field goal for the final margin. The Rams got one more possession with 25 seconds left, and Galvin, who threw for 4 TDs, was sacked on the final play. "Give credit to Montwood," Crane said. "They traveled down here 400 miles and played a heck of a football game. Their quarterback and running back and receivers are really good. They do a great job throwing the ball, and we knew it. They came down here and executed well. We've got to give them credit for that." The Bobcats had some costly penalties that could have ended up costing them the game, but they overcame those mistakes. The biggest one was on a 95-yard kickoff return by Cedric Fuentes that was called back by a holding penalty. Central ended up scoring on the ensuing possession anyway. "Penalties hurt us tonight," Crane said. "We had too many, and we've got to obviously look at that and try to clean it up on film. They weren't just penalties, they were hurtful penalties. We've got to clean that up if we're going to have an opportunity to be successful in the future." The Bobcats had a bend-but-not-break performance on the defensive side, trying to contain Montwood's high-powered offense. Offensively, Crane said it was a strong showing by the Cats. "Tyler played well. The offensive line played well," the Bobcats' second-year head coach said. "Really, our whole offense played well. I think we ended up punting one time all night. I was proud of them." Central running back Javian Robinson talked about the Bobcats' never-say-die attitude. "We were just trying to stay disciplined, you know," Robinson said. "We were trying to make minimal mistakes at crucial times, and I feel great that I was a part of it. I'm grateful that I'm on this team, and I really love my teammates." The Bobcats travel to Abilene Cooper next Friday to continue non-district play. "That's going to be a show for sure," Robinson said, looking ahead to next week with the Cougars. Lakeview Chiefs end 20-game losing streak to Sweetwater. By Amy McDaniel, published September 3rd. San Angelo Lakeview High School beat Sweetwater in football for the first time since 1983 with a 39-25 win over the Mustangs Friday at the Mustang Bowl. The Chiefs improved to 2-0 for the season. Sweetwater fell to 0-2. Lakeview's Michael Duran hauled in 2 fourth-quarter interceptions, including a pick-six with 1:43 to play to secure the win. Lakeview rallied from a 19-6 deficit, outscoring the Mustangs 27-6 after halftime to claim the win. The Chiefs led 27-25 and missed a chance to increase that lead when Sweetwater intercepted in the end zone. Duren, however, intercepted the ball at the Sweetwater 45-yard line with 3:11 to play. The Chiefs drove to the Mustang 12, capped by a 16-yard run by Rick Ramirez before Ian Cortez scored on a 12-yard run to give Lakeview a 33-25 lead with 2:47 to play. Duren's second interception of the night, his fourth for the season, halted the Mustang comeback attempt. It was the first win for the Chiefs in 21 tries against Sweetwater since 1983, a span of 39 years. In addition to Jim Slaughter, who was the Lakeview head coach in 1983, the Chiefs have been led by 10 head coaches since the last win over Sweetwater. Slaughter coached three more years, followed by Mark Gesch, Bill Hicks, Kyle Gandy, Billy Klemstein, Joey McQueen, Tim Reed, Sterling Gilbert, Doug Kuhlman, and current head coach Hector Guevara. Guevara, in his sixth season, has matched Kuhlman's tenure of six seasons. Gandy and Klemstein each coach for five seasons. Gandy's 1994 team won 10 games for the first time since Slaughter's 10-win total in 1982. Guevara has compiled a 13-42 record in five seasons with the Chiefs, but has them off to a 2-0 start for the first time since 2020, when Sweetwater ended that streak with a 58-42 win over the Chiefs at home. On Friday on the road, the Chiefs were down 19-6 at the end of the first, but battled back to take a 20-19 halftime lead. Juan Ortiz and Ramirez each scoring a rushing TD in the second quarter to lead the comeback. Ramirez's 13-yard TD run in the third quarter gave the Chiefs a 27-19 lead before the Mustangs answered, pulling within 27-25 after a failed two-point conversion. Ramirez led the Chiefs' ground attack, rushing 22 times for 186 yards and three TDs. Cortez carried 17 times for 138 yards and a score. Lakeview hosts undefeated Vernon on Friday at San Angelo Stadium. Number 7 Angelo State football team shuts out Chandron State 35-0 in season opener by Charles Bryce, published September 2nd. It wasn't always pretty, but it was still a dominating performance by the number 7 Angelo State University football team on Thursday night. The Rams rolled to a 35-0 non-conference shutout against Chandron State at First Community Credit Union Field at LeGrand Stadium. ASU built a 14-0 cushion in the first quarter, and the Rams led 21-0 at the half. The Rams finished with 424 yards total offense compared to 224 for the Eagles. It was a much different story than last year when ASU rallied from a 24-0 deficit to edge the Eagles 28-24 in Chadron, Nebraska. Rams head coach Jeff Gersh said the thing that pleased him the most Thursday was how physical ASU was on both sides of the ball. "When you pitch a shutout, obviously you had a great day on defense," Gersh said. "We were so physical, and we matched them, and we knew we had to be. Last year, Chadron State, quite frankly, beat us up in the first half. I thought this year we came out and played really clean football in the first half. In the second half, it got a little sloppy. We had some selfish penalties, so we've got to continue to get better on that, and those are things that championship-caliber teams will do." Overall, with the score says 35-0, you're happy with it. But from week one to week two, you've got to make great strides, and we're looking to do that this week in practice. ASU will travel to Colorado School of Mines for a top 10 showdown on Saturday, September 10th. Kickoff is scheduled for 1 p.m. Central Time in Golden, Colorado. Rams senior quarterback Zach Bronckhorst completed 18 of 34 passes for 233 yards and two touchdowns. He also ran for a 10-yard TD in the fourth quarter. Zach looked great, minus the 15-yard penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct after the touchdown, Gersh said. "He's a leader, and he's a competitor. He apologized to me at the end of it. I got after him pretty good. At the end of the day, that kid's a fierce competitor. I love him, and I'm so happy he's on this football team." ASU running back Alfred Greer carried 13 times for a game-high 111 yards rushing. Teammate Nate Omayabu had 16 attempts for 87 yards and one TD. Noah Massey led ASU's receiving corps with 5 interceptions for 75 yards and one TD, and Rasheen Green snagged 3 for 72. Chadron quarterback Heath B. Miller was held to 6 of 25 passing for 60 yards, no TDs, and 2 interceptions. He was the Eagles' top rusher with 18 carries for 90 yards. Jordan McKinney returned B. Miller's second pick, 41 yards for a TD, late in the fourth quarter. Andrew Pitts had the first one earlier in the fourth. The first one, there was a guy running right down the middle of the field who was wide open, the Rams coach said. It was a great play that we had an interception, but there was a guy running, so we've got to get that fixed. We're very athletic in the secondary. Andrew Pitts has been a guy who I think averages a pick a game. He's one of those dudes that the ball just seems to find. He's so athletic, and then Jordan McKinney stepping in. It's his first time to start full-time, and he's done a great job of working the system at Angelo State and understanding player development, and I'm so proud of him. He's got that interception and returned it for a touchdown, and he's a special football player. Former San Angelo Central High School receiver Thomas Eich caught a 7-yard TD pass from Bronkhorst. He's a D1 transfer from the University of Arizona. His father, Theron Eich, is a former offensive coordinator at ASU. The former tight ends inside receivers coach at Arizona was the wide receivers coach at UTEP last season. He is currently the offensive coordinator at Tennessee State. ASU freshman running back Braden Wilcox had one carry for 3 yards. The former Cristobal High School quarterback was the Standard Times All-West Texas 11-man football team MVP in 2020. And now here's the column from Allison Watkins. Fall is an ideal time for planting trees and shrubs. Published September 1st. Fall is always my favorite season, but the tougher the summer, the happier I am for September to come along. The recent rain will do a world of good for struggling plants and will soften the ground to make planting easier. Fall is the best season for planting many types of plants. So make plans now for planting trees, shrubs, perennials, herbs, and cool season color. Trees and shrubs are the most valuable permanent plants of the landscape, so take time to carefully choose and plan what to plant. Then use good design principles to place in the right location and best planting techniques to get a successful result. Plant large shade trees at 45-degree angles off the front corners of the home, so they frame the home and highlight it, not in front of the home, to block it and or visually divide it in half. Plant large shrubs at the corners and smaller dwarf shrubs closer to the front door. Choose dwarf shrubs for the front of the home that grow to the appropriate size at their mature age so that regular shearing and pruning is not necessary. Planting depth is very important for woody plants. Don't dig the holes deeper than the root ball. Planting trees just a few inches too deep can cause major health and aesthetic issues. Amend soil with compost when planting shrubs, but not trees. Shade trees have large, extensive root systems that must be adapted to the native soil. It's impossible to amend all the soil the roots will eventually occupy, but planting beds where shrubs, perennials, annuals, and ground covers will grow should be tilled up and amended with good quality plant-based compost. Organic matter in the soil will improve plant performance and reduce the need for fertilizer. Finish off with a 3 to 4 inch deep layer of wood mulch. Research has shown that mulch can help woody plants grow bigger, faster. It helps keep weed competition at bay, moderates soil temperature, prevents evaporation, etc. Always water new plants in immediately after planting and hand water for the first few weeks. Don't rely on automatic irrigation until they begin to establish. For more info on planting trees, as well as a variety of other topics, such as lawn care, landscape design, floral design, pass-along plants, and plant propagation, join us for the Fall Landscaping Symposium, hosted by the Concho Valley Master Gardeners on Saturday, September 10th. To sign up and for details, visit https://txmg www.cityofconchovalley.org/Concho Valley or call 325-659-6522. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.